Horror movies are more than just empty thrills. They are a mirror that reflects the darker sides of our culture and our psyche. Each episode, we will go beyond the first cut and discuss the themes and topics that hide below the surface.
I'm Dave, Professor of Communication.
And I'm Vince, Professor of Psychology. Welcome to A Dark Impression. Toys, they can entertain, puzzle, comforts, and help children create worlds through imagination. Whether it's a simple ball, a doll, an action figure, a puzzle, or a fluffy bear won at the traveling fair, they're a staple of childhood. Children will infuse them with a life as they carry them around. But what happens when something else, something dark and malevolent, takes control of the toy? What nightmares can they unleash on the mind of a child? Did it move? Heart racing. You scramble for your bedside lamp and flick it on. Bah! It's just that giant teddy bear you won at the traveling carnival. You turn the light off, just for a second, and the monster's back, ready to pounce. What is it about toys that, years later, still gives some adults the creeps? How can a doll, a simple doll, inspire fear when we know it's harmless? Why do so many childhood fears manifest as anxieties in adult life? The films we'll discuss today, Child's Play and Annabelle Creation, look to take your childhood's fear and transform them into something real, something that can haunt you, hurt you, kill you.
Child's Play, directed in 1988 by Tom Holland, not that Tom Holland, stars Chris Sarandon as Detective Mike Norris and Catherine Hicks, the mom from Seventh Heaven, as maybe next time opt for the gift card, Karen Barclay. Annabelle Creation from 2017 was directed by David F. Sandberg and produced by James Wan. It's a part of his Conjuring universe and is the second in the series, but the first chronologically. Stars Anthony LaPaglia, Samara Lee, and Miranda Otto. So Vince, let's dive right into it. This was your idea to talk about these films, and I think the first question I have for you is why?
I don't know that I can remember like specific nightmares from childhood about toys. All of my toys, you know, fell dead once I stopped playing with them. But I don't know. I think that's a running theme. And so we picked two movies for this episode, but there's plenty of other movies like Dead Silence that use this common trope of the toy. We've already discussed the movie Poltergeist, and there's a great example there of a possessed toy. So this is something that a common theme, an object that should be harmless, that should be a positive thing, being used and co-opted by this evil force. So I thought that was an interesting theme to approach. Plus, from a developmental perspective, we've talked a lot about teenagers, but now these movies really address childhood. So I thought that was a different angle that could be worth a conversation. Plus, I mean, Chucky is such an iconic character, and Annabelle, even though it's a recent addition to the catalog of horror movies, I think Annabelle has made its way into popular culture. So, yeah, two good examples. What do you think of those two movies?
I mean, I hadn't seen any of the Annabelle movies before, but
Scandal.
I know what the doll looks like. You know, it immediately came to mind when you said, let's watch Annabelle Creation. I was like, okay, and I pictured her in my head. So, yeah, I think that she is in the popular zeitgeist.
I think that's something interesting about some specific monsters and characters, that you remember the name of the character better than remember the name of the movie. So most people mm-hmm. will think of Jason, Freddy, Chucky, and now Annabelle, and not necessarily remember Annabelle's, the title of the movie is Annabelle. But for other movies, it's interesting that we remember the monster more than whatever title the movie company decides to give the movie.
Yeah, I'm going to have to try really hard today to not call Child's Play Chucky, because that's always what I think of it in my head, is like Chucky, Chucky 1, Chucky 2, Chucky 3.
Chuck E. Cheese.
But Chuck E. Cheese.
Terrifying place. Yeah. So yeah, for our listeners, whatever he says, Chucky, we won't edit that out. We'll just make sure to point it out to Dave that
We can judge it later. Play. Yeah, that's fine. The thing I really liked about Annabelle Creation was the way that they paced the actual horror delivery within the film, because it was very much a drama for at least half the film, probably about two thirds of the film. It was about a couple who lost a daughter and they took in some orphans and there's some weird stuff happening, but it's kind of in the back burner. Once you get to that halfway point, when the little girl turns around and she says, "Your soul," and turns into the demon, yeah, which scared me. I jumped. That is kind of the turning point of, okay, it moves from drama to horror. But they did such a good job of pacing that that you kind of, or at least I kind of forgot that there were horror elements coming up. There's a creepy doll, but I was like invested in this the story, the characters, you know, how things were unfolding there. And then it just reminds you very, very suddenly, very quickly that this is a horror. And that Chucky did not, or there it is, Child's Play.
Number one.
Did not do that by any means. It just started off right away. The guy runs into the toy store. He gets shot a couple times. He does some voodoo ritual, and yep, his soul gets moved over to the doll. And you immediately know where that's going.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a completely different pacing for the two movies. Both of them centered around the same kind of topic, which is the doll. But one of them, the Chucky, I pretty reminiscent of, or pretty typical, I guess, of horror movies of the 80s. So you have a mix of horror and comedy, and we'll talk about that a little later. But then you have Annabelle that starts in a way that reminded me of The Changeling. So it starts with a movie that's camped in grief and of the unwillingness of the father character to let go and the mysterious mother. But like you said, this complete 90-degree turn that came out of, that was a good spook. That one scene, really well executed. But yeah, completely different pacing, and the third act was just dense.
There was a few really nice moments in there that reminded me of being a kid again. In the bunk bed scene where she runs away and then climbs up to the top bunk to escape the demon, and she's kind of looking down in the crack, and she sees like the demon's looking back at her, and its hands come up.
Peek-a-boom.
And I'm like, man, like I remember my bed was against the wall and like hearing something and trying to look in there to see if there's any, you know, demon under my bed.
I
brought me back.
I think so. No fears of dolls, but bunk beds. I think as I get the whole saving space by going vertical, but there's no good choice between the lower bunk and the higher bunk. I know that people might disagree, but I look at that and both of them are problematic. So that in itself just generates anxiety. Like, you're on the top bunk, you're going to fall over. You're in the bottom bunk, someone's going to fall over you. There's no way out.
The real horror of Annabelle Creation was
the bunk bed.
The bunk beds.
Yes. Forget about the doll.
So I guess one of the things that's common in both of these films, and it's something you mentioned in the introduction, was this idea of childhood fears manifesting themselves as adult anxieties. Why are these movies, why do you think these movies are still scary for us, even though we know that dolls aren't alive, dolls aren't going to chase after me with a knife or, you know, kill me in my sleep or whatever?
Yeah, hopefully. I have to say that first murder in Child's Play with the tiny little hammer that hits the woman in the face and she missteps out of a window from like the fifth story. That one actually just made me crack up.
It was a pretty good one.
Yeah, the most unlikely murder. But yeah, it's so, if you ask people in the vast field of psychology, why do childhood fears sometimes translate into adult anxieties? There might be more than one way to interpret that. Personally, I have a very biological perspective on behavior. And it's interesting that the brain develops throughout childhood. And I mean, I think most parents will be able to remember this instance where their child kind of runs around, stumbles, and then instead of starting to cry automatically in pain, turns around to look at the adult, trying to gauge what should be my emotional reaction. As a teenager, I was a camp counselor, and that was that always happened. Like, kid's going to run into a tree because kid doesn't realize that trees won't move. Kid falls to the ground, turns around, looks at me, and tries to gauge, should they be crying in pain or not? And then if you panic, then the child panics. I think there's that period in childhood where there's a learning of the emotional reactivity, like what's appropriate for the situation, whether it's I ran into a tree and I'm wondering, should I be in pain right now, or things like fear. And as you age, there's brain maturation until hopefully the adult brain is able to generate the right amount of emotion for a situation and then also calibrate the amount of emotion. We tend to kind of pick on fear and stress and anxiety as bad things. But they're not necessarily bad. Like if you live in a dangerous environment, being anxious actually might save your life. So it's calibrating the emotion that's the key. And so childhood is that period where you learn how to properly calibrate your emotional reaction. So I think that's part of it. Like in some instances, depending on different factors relative to the person and their childhood environment, you'll develop with an appropriate level of stress and anxiety and fear, or with a disproportionate amount. So that's interesting. I think as adults, we still carry some of those anxieties from childhood.
Yeah, that makes sense. I like to imagine I live in a dangerous place, so my anxiety is founded, but I don't believe it is.
Right. A friend of mine gave a presentation a year ago, and so he worked on the development of fear in rats. And he said, you know what, if a rat is fearful, like it's an anxious rat, and it lives in a threatening environment, the rat is probably going to stay to hiding places and avoid dangers. But that's a hard life. And then if you're the happy-go-lucky rat and you live in a safe environment, well, you don't have any problem. The problem is, if you're the happy-go-lucky rat that lives in a threatening environment, you might actually wander in areas where there's a bird that might just come and snatch you. So the appropriate amount of fear for the environment is a good thing to have. Anxiety and fear should always be in proportion to the environment you're in. And the funniest thing is that after he gave that presentation, I went for a walk and I saw a squirrel cross the road. And as the squirrel was crossing, a bird came by and swooped and caught the squirrel. Well, that was your happy-go-lucky squirrel. Should have been a little more fearful. But yeah, that's the thing about fear. It's a useful emotion that tells you there's a threat around. And if you don't have enough, it might get you into trouble. And if you have too much, it might also get you into trouble. So that's, and play as a child is a way to explore those kinds of situations. As you play, you challenge yourself, you put yourself in more dangerous situations, challenging situations. So play is useful for children to learn their own capacity to deal with fear and anxiety. How that carries into adulthood, well, that can depend. I think as children, we don't see how creepy dolls can be and how weird toys can be. And I think it's once you leave that period where I think it's normal to engage in play with different things. Once you leave that developmental period, you start looking back on those things and go, well, that was weird. That's strange. Picture Annabelle's face and picture Chucky's face. Those are weird. Those movies are successful by tapping into how, as adults, we've now disconnected ourselves from childhood.
Mm.
And that brings a little feeling of weirdness, which brings me to a question I wanted to discuss with you. Both movies rest on props. Like Chucky is an iconic prop, and Annabelle is now becoming an iconic prop. So from your perspective, like what goes into crafting those props and what goes into the movie maker's mind when it comes to creating a cool prop like that or creepy prop?
Sure. Yeah. So in looking at both of those, I was thinking about how similar they look to popular toys, but how different they are so that they avoid, you know, lawsuits and copyright infringement and stuff like that. So, you know, Chucky is, at least from my perspective, the closest thing I can get is a mix of a Cabbage Patch doll and maybe like Teddy Ruxpin, if you remember Teddy Ruxpin. Mm-hmm. He put a cassette tape in his back and he talks to you.
Yep.
And Annabelle looks almost exactly like my daughter's American Girl doll, just a little bit larger. So I would imagine that Annabelle was very much inspired by American Girl dolls, or maybe the other way around, since Annabelle is apparently from like the 1930s or something.
Yep.
So in the Conjuring universe,
right.
American Girl dolls have sprung. They exist in the Conjuring universe, I would imagine. They sprung from Annabelle. They're all haunted. So I think that a key in creating them lies in making something that's instantly recognizable, something that you can look at and say, oh yeah, I had one of those, or I had something a lot like this growing up. Something that is not so far removed that you have a hard time making that mental leap between, oh, would a kid really play with this thing? The Good Guy dolls, which Chucky is one of, which I thought, nice irony there, is that cartoon could have existed
right
in the late 80s, early 90s. Like, I would have watched that cartoon. Oh, real quick, I just wanted to mention, you talked about the cereal.
Yes.
Him delivering his mom the breakfast in bed was the most horrifying thing in that movie. I'm like, oh my God, you're going to have to clean up he put sugar on the cereal. There's orange juice all over the place. So much butter.
Sugar on the cereal.
Which was something that my grandmother did. She would give me like Frosted Flakes and she'd be like, you want sugar on it? I'm like, yeah, yeah, of course I do.
The true horror of that movie is diabetes.
And that's it, folks. So one of the things that they did in both of the films was they used a technique called eyelight on the dolls. And what eyelight does is usually on actors, and it creates a little glint of light in the actor's eyes. And if you look at any film, you'll see eyelight in your actors, because otherwise they look like they have these like dead soulless eyes without just a glint of light. And so they use that technique on the dolls to make them feel alive. Annabelle, I noticed there were some parts when she was just a doll that the eyelight was missing. And then when she was a doll that would look at stuff and turn her head, the eyelight was there.
Interesting.
So it was a nice way to kind of cue us in as to, you know, you should expect something to happen pretty soon because Annabelle's aware of what's going on.
That's really cool. I had no idea that was something that was used to generate lifelike in movies.
Yeah, look around. Any show or movie you watch, look at the eyes and you'll see that there's always one, if they do a good job, there's always one pinprick of light in the subject's eyes.
Cool.
Yeah, the eye light, I think, is a great way to suffuse life into something that's inanimate. But I think that in talking a little bit, we talked a bit about the Uncanny Valley, and I'd like to get your thoughts on that and how the dolls look close enough to real to be recognizable, but not so much that they're off-putting or obviously like they're trying to be too realistic.
Yeah, the Uncanny Valley is an interesting concept that I was not super familiar with until recently reading a little bit about it. But essentially, it's a concept that was proposed by a Japanese scientist to explain this kind of relationship that we have with automated objects and androids and robots. So to put that into context, there are some phobias of inanimate objects that have a human-like figure. Automatonophobia is the fear of human-like figures, and that is a mouthful. And then you have something related, so the fear of clowns, coulrophobia, and you have a specific kind of phobia related to dolls, which is pediophobia. All of these kind of suggest that there is this type of averse reaction that humans have to objects that display enough human characteristic to be uncomfortable because they're not quite human. And dolls kind of fall in that kind of category. And I was reading a really interesting review article by Wang, Lilienfeld, and Rochat in Review of General Psychology from 2015, where they essentially went through, like, does it exist? Is the Uncanny Valley a scientific concept that we can study in psychology? So they did a really good job at kind of reviewing the description of the phenomenon, which is essentially says that between a machine and a human looking at the machine, there's going to be this increase in a feeling of pleasantness. And there lies a bit of the problem is the whole concept was translated from Japanese into English. And the word pleasantness isn't as well translated. But essentially, we react more and more pleasantly to machines that have a certain human feel. So Roomba, not so much. And then you have like the creepy robots from, was it Boston Dynamics that dance? Those we react positively to. But then there's weird zone where things look similar enough to what would be human-like, but not enough. And so that instead of increasing our feeling of pleasantness, people tend to react badly to that. And they were mentioning in the review article about the King from Burger King. I don't know if you remember that mascot. It was retired because people said it looked unpleasant and creepy. Well, that's an example. How did I was wondering, where did the King go? Lo and behold, people found him creepy. Same thing for Ronald McDonald. How many mascots are... Anyways, so the reason why... So they're discussing in this review article whether it is a psychological concept, and the conclusion is that there's enough evidence, and I'm summarizing this, but I guess there's enough evidence to show that there's something there, but the nature of that reaction that we have needs better studies to really fully understand what's the reaction that we have. And then they go into possible explanations, whether it's about evolutionary psychology and our need to detect what is human versus non-human, and those spaces kind of fall in between. And because it's in the in-between, it's uncomfortable. Like, should I treat it like my Roomba, or should I treat it like my neighbor? How should I treat that object? There are some interpretations from terror management theory, which is a theory in the psychodynamic world, so post-Freudian theories, that says essentially that things that remind us of our mortality trigger powerful emotional reactions, and dolls will remind us of our mortality. So there's a lot of different explanations for why there is that phenomenon of the uncanny valley. And I think those dolls tap into that aspect, except for when Chucky actually animates itself, and then it's bye-bye uncanny valley. It's just creepy.
Yeah, I was gonna say, because he looks like a doll for the first probably half of the movie, and then when he yells at the mom, he turns into more of a human,
right?
And he starts getting wrinkles on his face and expression lines around his mouth, right?
Yep.
And then he becomes even more terrifying than just a doll running around with a little hammer,
right?
And he becomes like a little person trapped in a doll's body, which is somehow worse. Annabelle never makes that jump.
No, but
Annabelle is always Annabelle. She turns her head.
Right. But you know that Annabelle is a cue for the demon that's coming.
Right. And I think that's one of the big differences. The serial killer is in the body of the toy.
Right.
Whereas Annabelle is just a conduit.
Right. And there's this concept of the violation of expectation, which helps understand the reaction that we have to Chucky. And because we expect objects to be a certain way and to do a certain set of things, or to have a certain voice, and so to have that cute little doll now take on those evil facial features and start swearing and threatening, that's a violation of expectation. We're really sensitive to having a world that's predictable. We like to know what we can expect of objects and people, and possessed dolls kind of ruin that.
I mentioned this briefly before, but I just wanted to quickly talk a little bit more about how they cut the scary portions and the frenetic pace in which that happened, as opposed to the non-scary portions of the film. When there was horror happening, it was so fast-paced, there was jarring cuts, there was constant movement. And then when it was more drama time or slowdown time, the editing really reflected that. And I just thought that was a great transition. There was no kind of scaling up from drama to horror.
Right.
It was immediately in. And And I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the editing of that film. I enjoyed the pacing of the script. I just thought it was an enjoyable film as a whole. I thought they did a great job of creating tension within it, because you never knew when to expect the really fast-paced cutting.
What I really appreciated about that movie is that they didn't shy away from revealing the demon and revealing the evil, and they didn't shy away from some gore either, but they didn't overuse it. It was used very efficiently, just tiny bits, little bits of it. The scene where the father and his hand, and I don't want to give out too many spoilers, but they, all of them were done just rightly so, never saturating you or saturating the viewer, but still not coming up short. It was in that sweet spot of just enough.
Right, right. Two things from Child's Play that I noticed. See, I didn't do it that time. I called it by its correct name.
Well done.
Was one at the end, the knife through the door, which was very reminiscent of The Shining.
Yes.
I don't know if you noticed that, but it was just on the other side of the door. She was on the left instead of Shelley Duvall on the right. And he was stabbing the knife through the door, and to the point that she was even almost mimicking Shelley Duvall's facial expressions. I really appreciated that nod. And then there was, I guess between both films, there was two characters of color. I noticed it mostly in Child's Play. Everybody's white except for the voodoo guy, who's black, and he's in the film for about 30 seconds.
Yes.
And I just realized in Annabelle, the only person of color was the nun.
There was one of the teenagers also.
Was there?
Yes. But yes.
Maybe it was just mostly, limited people of color in the films, but especially Child's Play. I was like, you couldn't find... I guess like the friend's mom or the mom's friend, I guess the mom's friend was Italian.
Yes.
And I don't know if that counts. In the 80s, did that count as diversity?
I don't know. But for something set in Chicago, they kind of missed an opportunity there.
They could have done better.
Yes.
Yeah. They could have done better.
Yeah. No, from my perspective, Child's Play kind of left me on my appetites with the use of voodoo. I think this is one kind of trope in horror movies that sometimes leaves me feeling a little blah, is that kind of instrumental borrowing from a really complex culture and a really rich set of belief just to patch this kind of hole in the plot. They could have gone for anything. They could have gone for sort of satanic mumbo jumbo or whatnot. But no, they had to go for voodoo for the appearance of one character for about 30 seconds, and then he dies. I was like, that's eh. On the other hand,
lazy script
writing. Yeah, it was a little lazy. On the other hand, I am a fan of the universe that the Conjuring creators have generated. This interaction between, and you can see a lot of references to different movies. The movie Annabelle creation ends with a tie into the first Annabelle movie, which was by no means as good as Annabelle creation, but still an interesting installment. You have a reference to the movie The Nun. You have a reference. So there's such a logic in that universe that it makes it believable. Even the names of the demons are taken from, I guess, legit demonology, if there is such a thing as legit demonology. But you can go into the Infernal Dictionary and the demons are there. Like, those names exist. So the guys that created that movie actually did their research, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, I also like that they only give out enough information to get you started with it.
Yes.
Like, you understand what's going on, but they never hand feed you things. So in the case of Annabelle creation, if they were to do a voodoo scene, I can't imagine them ever going to visit the voodoo guy
right
down the line. They would have just said, if you don't get it, then you don't get it. Right. You know, something happened.
Yep.
You can go do your own research. And I really appreciate that. It feels smarter, and it makes me feel, when I get things, it makes me feel smart.
Right. Oh.
It takes a lot to get to that point to make me feel smart, but I appreciate it in the Conjuring movie.
There's one more reference. I don't know if it was an Easter egg, but this was a great reference. The scene in Annabelle Creation where there's a malfunctioning of the chairlift, was that a subtle homage to Gremlins? I think it was. I want to think that James Wan,
I would imagine,
thought there's a house, there's a chairlift, there's a girl with a disability who needs that. We will go the full Gremlins way, but instead of being ejected out of the house, she now goes somewhere in the ceiling and then comes back in a dramatic fashion. So it was the scary version of the Gremlins chairlift catapult scene, which I thought was absolutely amazing. Best reference that probably only I thought of.
Yeah, I missed it, but now that you say it, it makes complete sense. And James Wan, when you listen to this, please reach out to us and we can feature you as a guest spot.
Confirm that you have that in mind.
I'm sure that he's listening to it. Yeah.
Toys are great. Toys are great for horror movies because we get attached to them. We give them life. We give them personality. This is the way for children to explore the wider world and kind of relationships with an inanimate object. It's a way to develop your understanding of other people's feelings and whatnot. I think it's one of the best tropes in the genre to take this object that is supposed to be all positive and now twist it in a way that is evil, that is threatening, and that is deadly. And I think those two movies, Chucky, also known as Child Play, and Annabelle Creation, just did a wonderful job of infusing raw fear into those objects.
I definitely agree with you, 100%. These were a lot of fun to watch, for sure.
Yeah.
Thanks for recommending this as a topic. I'm glad that we did it.
Yeah.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to us. I hope you enjoyed this. Stay tuned for more episodes and for our Not Top 5 Top 5s.
Absolutely.
Have a good one. See you, Vince.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for taking the time to listen to A Dark Impression. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Rating and reviews make the world a scarier place. Consider leaving one wherever you get your podcasts. A Dark Impression was produced and edited by Vince and Dave. All movies are copyright their respective sources. Music is from Adobe Stock. All rights reserved.